This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Okay, good evening everyone. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. Thank you for coming. My name is Mohammed Patel. I'm the president of the Islamic Society. Feel free to take a seat. So we organized Islam Awareness Week and this is our final talk. So thank you all for coming. I'll also be your chair today. The format of this evening will be the talk by Brother Abdullah, then there'll be a Q&A session. We'll look to finish around 8 o'clock-ish. All right. So the title of the talk is The Solution to Poverty, the Islamic Economic System by Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi. Just a quick bio about the speaker. Abdullah Al-Andalusi is an international speaker, thinker and intellectual activist for Islam and Muslim affairs. His work involves explaining and demonstrating the intellectual proofs for Islamic beliefs and promoting the Islamic way of life and Islamic solutions for contemporary problems. Abdullah Al-Andalusi is of Christian Portuguese descent but embraced Islam at 14 after a period of study that started when he was 10 years old. He has continued to study Islam in depth ever since. He has spoken in community centres, universities, colleges and has numerous appearances on various TV channels including BBC, ITV and Islam Channel. He has also engaged in a number of debates with atheists, secularists, agnostics, liberals and Christians on a variety of topics from theology to political philosophy. In 2009 he co-founded the Public Discussion Forum, the Muslim Debate Initiative, a forum that promotes open dialogue and critical debate between thinkers, academics, politicians and public speakers of all backgrounds. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace be upon you all. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. As-salatu wa-salam Nabi Kareem Muhammad wa ala alihi tayyibin wa sahbihi salihin. Thank you to the University of East Anglia Student Union and Islamic Society for inviting me, and thank you all for coming for this very pertinent topic, considering the current global situation with the very long recession, which is still ongoing. There's much suffering, not just in third world countries from compound debt, but there's also suffering in Western countries from people being unemployed through industry slowing down. And I suppose the main issue would be the concentration of wealth, the wealth gap between the rich and the poor, which is getting larger. Now, I think these kind of questions, and this time people started to question again the what's called the capitalist system. And some people said, we didn't see this recession coming, even though it's kind of very predictable. I mean, it's been a cyclical nature with booms and busts in Western economics for centuries. So I don't think it was anything surprising. But people started to ask questions. Now, obviously, the only alternative people think about is that there's communism. Communism is the only alternative to the current system that we have. And of course, if you want to go down that route, obviously we've had bad experiences, the world has had bad experiences with the communist economic system. So I suppose the world is in a bit of a quandary as to what are the solutions to go with. But I think that also, it's not just the stability of the economic system that we have to look at, but also what the economic system, the political ramifications of an economic system and what it has caused throughout the world. So we see, for example, because of economic systems, because of economics and because of the desire for resources, there's many wars occurring in the world, and we see a revival of neocolonialism in some countries, especially in third world countries and so on, who are still struggling to free themselves from the shackles of foreign control, especially of their markets, which is even worse than being under military occupation. So if your market is under control, mainly due to compound interest. Now, there are basically three world views and philosophies concerning economics, or what they call the human economic problem. Obviously, there's liberalism. It's called liberalism now. It used to be called libertarianism, but the economic facet of this of liberalism is called capitalism, or as capitalism. The second, obviously, is communism, and the third I'd like to posit is Islam. And each of these three worldviews has a different approach to the human economic problem. Now, we'll start with, I suppose, the capitalist economic system. It frames the human economic problem as being one of humans have infinite needs or infinite wants, and there is only scarce resources. So, considering there is infinite needs, humans will have an infinite need for resources, for services and things, but there are scarce resources. It posits a solution, which is maximizing production. The solution to this problem, this quandary, is to maximize production. And then, hopefully, through what's called the trickle-down theory, I suppose, that if you maximize production, eventually everyone will get a share of the pie, will get a share of the resources. Now, in doing this, it will implement this kind of trickle-down distribution system through privileging entrepreneurs with incentives and tax breaks. Entrepreneurs are seen as the kind of the spearhead of capitalism. They are the driving force of capitalism. Without entrepreneurs, you wouldn't have development and growth, according to the capitalist worldview. It has an overly permissive approach, I would say, to ownership and disposal, which is unrestrained means of disposal and of property and ownership. For example, you have interest banking, which started a system whereby you'd have money, you'd make money just from money, rather than you'd make it from investment. And this created the idea that money is debt. So money is not no longer a means of exchange, but money itself is debt. So for example, the bank to give you money, or the bank even to print money, it's already debt. So with the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve Bank, which is not, contrary to what the name might depict, it's not the National Bank of America owned by the government, it's a private bank, and it prints money. And it prints money at a debt to the government. So basically the US government needs money for circulation. It will ask the bank to print this money and say, right, well, we'll make this money, but you have to pay us back, obviously, with interest. Of course, one wonders then, what can you pay them back with? If they're the ones who are making all the money, printing it rather, then where are you going to find the money to return that plus extra? And of course, fractional reserve banking. So again, the belief that we have we can use all kinds of different ways of making money unrestrictedly led banks to, I think, quite unscrupulously use fractional reserve banking, which is basically that they noticed that when you deposit money into the bank, that people generally don't use about 12 or 13 parts, 12 parts per 13. So what they did is they would re-lend that money out. So the money, you put $100 in the bank, or £100 in the bank, and the bank will lend that out 13 times to other people, claiming to everyone that it lends it out to that, don't worry, this is money in the bank, so we're lending out to you, and hoping that no one would basically come to that bank and withdraw that money at the same time. So if everyone withdrew their money at the same time, the bank would basically collapse. It would need to be bailed out by the government, because all the money it's basically lending doesn't actually exist. But it balances its books by basically if it gives out money, it puts out on its account that there's a minus. So basically, when it gives out money and it puts in its accounts a minus, on the accounting books it looks like it's balanced. But really, they're actually inventing money and then lending it out. And the fractional reserve banking is one of these, you could say, innovations which occurred in the capitalist system. And of course, in such a situation, when you need the entrepreneurs to develop your economy, to grow your economy, you have to, you have to basically, give them some latitude, give them some privilege. And of course, when you do that, when the bill comes, when you obviously have to, money starts being concentrated in that society, who's going to pay, who's going to basically bail out the banks? It will be you, the people. And when you bail out the banks, you're basically, with your own taxpayer money, you're basically paying the banks to lend you money with interest, basically. And this is, I think, some of the things which has occurred due to the idea that you should have a very liberal approach to in innovating kind of financial products and financial services, without no regard to the possible consequences that this might occur, such as obviously inflation and interest is the primary cause between concentration of wealth, if you consider it. And just think about how the process works. You have, let's say the rich 1% or the rich the banks on the top, and you have, you know, the remainder. Let's say you have, you know, the remaining 99%. Rather, it's more like rather you have 1%, then you have like the next 20%, and then you have the remaining 80%. Now, if you're one of these 80% people, and you need to basically have money, you need to basically have money to start a business. You don't have the capital, so you have to ask that 1% or that 20% for the money, and they will lend it to you with expectation of you paying back more than what you took from them. Now, okay, so you make your business and you sell to your fellow poor people and you make some profit. When the time comes to pay the piper, you have to pay back the principal sum back to the bank plus the additional, what's owed in interest. If you look at the net direction of money, where is the net flow of money? It's not going from the rich to the poor. The net flow of money is going from the poor to the rich. And this is the basic principle of why you have concentration of wealth due to interest banking. Also, in the capitalist system, it has this conception of a human called the economic man. That basically what drives human beings is the model it uses is that, you know, purely economic concerns, so that we'd be, you know, humans would be the most efficient creatures when it comes to getting resources and then and disposing of those resources. But what it doesn't understand, or rather what it maybe ignores, is that humans are not just business. We're not businessmen or businesswomen. We're human, and we have many different drives and desires. Sometimes, for example, we'd want to donate money, just give money away for spiritual causes, for social causes. You know, not just as part of some, you know, very shrewd investment. So there are many different motivations behind a human being beyond just purely the economic. So looking at a human being as the economic man, you actually have framed humans as being very materialistic and selfish. But human beings have a capacity to be beyond materialistic and selfish. They can actually be very altruistic. Now, okay, you hear it's very cliche about the concentration of wealth, and it's cliche about, you know, I mean, we've all heard about the fractional reserve banking problem. We've all heard that money is debt, and you can't have money without debt. You know, these two things are interlinked. But it wasn't always so, and there is some evidences, I mean, there is very strong evidences, which I think many economists know here, of why the capitalist system has led to lead to concentration of wealth, and you see evidence for this. For example, the World Institute did a study for development economics research and concluded that in the world, globally, it's no mystery to economics students here, 40% of global assets, 40% of global assets are owned by 1% of the population of the world. And of course, 50% of the population of the world only own 1% of global assets and finances. If you think that's bad, I mean, you think that's just bad globally, let's go into the rich country, let's go into America, you know, America, great standing of living, according to the Hollywood movies at least, and, you know, they would appear, this is a very rich country, obviously it's benefited quite a lot from its economic adventures at the point of a gun, and it's basically been, you know, it's viewed as a very, you know, a rich country which has opportunities for all. But even in America, we actually see the same kind of concentration statistics. So we see, again, in America, 1% of households own 35.4% of all privately held wealth. So even in America, you see very similar concentrations of wealth. And we see that the bottom 80% of the population of Americans own 11% of the wealth in America. So we're seeing that even in a rich country which implements capitalism, there is this concentration of wealth attribute. Now, if you might think, okay, sure, concentration of wealth, so what? I mean, okay, sure, maybe you know, you get the Bill Gates and you get all the Donald Trumps and all these people, that's fine. But just because they have, you know, enormous wealth and maybe even the largest share of the wealth, how is that a problem? How is that? Maybe that's not really an issue. As long as everyone gets to eat and everyone gets to live in a household, and that's all fine, isn't it? Well, that's the problem, because not everyone gets to eat and not everyone gets to live in a household. At least they don't get to eat from their normal means. For example, in 2008, it was discovered that 15% of American households were not food secure for the entire year. Not food secure. I mean, this isn't the country where one in three people are obese, and there are 50% of households that were not food secure. Even if you just look in the UK, the UK Consumer Group, which noticed in 2011 that one in four people in the UK had to use their savings to buy food and the daily essentials in the UK. So it's not just concentration of wealth is like, you know, maybe it's just something for the a random, you know, socialist in Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park to rant on about, but rather that actually there's actual effects we see on the ground. And of course, I mean, we know that other aspects of capitalism, which I will go through by juxtaposing with the Islamic system, has led to other such problems, such as obviously inflation for the fiscal inflation, mainly due to quantitative easing, or what they call printing money. Basically, they just print lots of money, devalues the money. We see that there's excessive production and waste. Excessive wastage in Western societies from food and from produce. And of course, further afield, we see that in many countries, the people who make the clothes you're wearing, they make it for a pittance, working sometimes 16-hour days. Some of them, a lot of them are kids. Debt slavery, as we call it, or wage slavery, the modern-day wage slavery. And of course, we see that if you have to maximize production, and there's only a finite number of resources in any, England probably doesn't have as much resources anymore for its modern industry compared to obviously the Industrial Revolution when it used coal, and coal was abundant in England, but now it uses petrol, uses nuclear power. It has to get these resources from some way. It has to maximize production by getting these resources. So does America. And how do they get that when they need to keep feeding resources into this juggernaut of their economy? Otherwise, you'll see it'll collapse if there's no more resources to kind of facilitate the poorest people. Hopefully, through this trickle-down effect, you might get certain problems you'll witness. So they have to go out to other countries, and they have to buy one means or the other. Either through diplomacy, through negotiation, a lot of the time through economic bullying, as they did in South America, and of course in warfare if they need to. And this is the cause that motivates them, and we see this. Thank you. Now, okay, I've made a lot of assertions there, and again, I'm going to revisit those assertions when I juxtapose the Islamic solutions to a number of those problems, and then we'll see the comparison for yourself. What about communism? Well, okay, communism is not really the system which is practiced by many countries today, short of North Korea and Cuba, although Cuba does have a good health system. But it is, obviously, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, people don't really take it seriously anymore. Whenever there's a recession, though, they will go to the bookshops and buy more books of Karl Marx's Das Kapital to make them feel better. But in essence, anyway, how communism views the humans, and this is a very gross simplification because there's many different strands of communism. There are communists who probably won't agree with this, but generally the main stream of thought is basically that matter is the basis of all things. All things are matter. And the production of the material things is by the workers. So workers are all that matters. That is basically, it's a very crude and simplified nutshell. But in essence, the proletariat, the workers, are the only thing that matters. And we are all equal in that we all matter. We're all part of the kind of dialectical materialism worldview of communism. We're all equal, and so everyone deserves or should get an equal share of what is produced by the economic system. Although this varies according to different kind of communist schools of thought. Now, it agrees with capitalism on one of the basic things, that production is the problem. So it has to maximize production. But when it comes to distribution of wealth, it achieves that by most predominant school believes in rigid equality. So whatever profession you do, and how much better you are at it than your colleague, you deserve to get the same wage if you have the same number of people in your family to look after and so on and so forth. All things being equal, you get the same wage as anybody else, irrespective of your ability or merit. Now, there are problems with the communist economic system, mainly because private property is seen as theft. no one can own any property. It's rather, it's we all collectively own the property. So how they try to manage this is that through a number of ways, many different means, and they're all sometimes contradictory, but in essence, they didn't allow a free market. They don't believe in a free market. And in order to kind of regulate supply and demand, they use a planned economic system. So they plan it. They plan how much supply will be produced and how much and you know who how it'll be distributed and who gets to have this distribution and so on. The problem is that an economic system is so complex because it involves a whole number of human beings, you know, millions of human beings, that you just can't plan it. You just can't plan that sophisticated level, because you see, if I want to increase production of forks, for example, I need to have metal and I need to have refineries available. And if I increase production of metal and divert it to forks, that will be less metal being used to make life support machines, probably, or to make baking tins or whatever. And without using the kind of the mechanism of supply, demand, and price, it leads to problems, because what you'll get is you'll get shortages that you didn't plan, you didn't foresee. And this is why in the communist and Soviet system, we saw that people lacked sometimes, many times, basic goods like bread and meat and so on and so forth. So the human economics is too sophisticated for a planned economic system to really cater for the intricacies and sometimes the sheer chaos of an economic system. And of course, the main contention against communism is that humans need an incentive to work. They need an incentive to improve their work and develop. Because if you're going to pay someone exactly the same amount of money, irrespective of what they do, where is the incentive for them to improve themselves? Where is the incentive for them to do overtime and to be have attention to detail? You just can't have faith that people's a materialistic worldview will generate in people a desire for the greater good, when human beings don't work like that. I mean, we want to see some kind of reward, or we want to feel some kind of reward by some means. Of course, communists then developed a way of motivating people. They were called political officers or commissars. And the trip, your family, all expenses paid, trip to a gulag. So you can, that was one way of motivating people. But unfortunately, it doesn't really help a vibrant and dynamic economic system. So then, what about the Islamic economic system? Well, and this is going to sound very radical. Humans have finite needs. Food, clothing, shelter. How much food do you need to eat to survive? And so survive comfortably. How much shelter do you need? Do you need a massive palace to survive? Must everyone have 10 houses or 5 houses or infinite number of houses and so on? How much clothing do you need? I'm not referring to Paris Hilton. She probably does need infinite and so on. That probably refutes me, but when it comes to everyone else, it's only a finite amount of clothes you need to survive. You need a finite amount of energy, i.e. heat, to keep yourself warm, depending on where you live in the world and the climate. And of course, these things are basic, finite requirements to be a human, to live as a human being. Of course, Islam also looks into other human needs, such as the right to have a reproductive partner. And also, healthcare and education are also rights, and they're also finite. I mean, you only need there's only so much medicine you can take, and there's only so much education you can take up to the limits of human knowledge, and then obviously you'll be doing a PhD or something. So these are finite needs. Now, Islam recognizes that there is a profit motive, which is part of the human economic motivation, and Islam ensures that desires are directed by a profit motive, but also by a spiritual motive. It values altruism and philanthropy, not just self-interest. Now, the Islam recognizing humans to seek profit, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, if the son of Adam was given a valley full of gold, he would love to have a second one. And if he was given a second one, he'd want to have a third one, and nothing fills his belly except dust, which is an expression in Arabic meaning that he won't be satisfied till he's dead, basically. So the Prophet Muhammad is commenting that humans, they need to acquire. They want to acquire. But at the same time, the Quran says, and it says to Muslims, but seek through that which God has given you the home of the hereafter. And do not forget your share of this world, and do good as God has done good to you, and desire not corruption in the land. Indeed, God does not like corruptors. That whole verse actually sums up the entire Islamic economic system. That using the means that we are given to us, using the money we have, the wealth we have, our aims as humans is to worship the Creator, is to do good. It's to actually help people and feel that reward of helping people for its own sake, that spiritual value. It's not a materialistic value. If I donate half my paycheck, let's just say for example, to the poor, that's a bad economic decision for me. But if in a spiritual value, it's a very good decision for me. So in a nutshell, that whole verse actually kind of sums up the Islamic economic system. That even seeking the spiritual values, don't neglect your portion. So don't say, right, I shall become a pauper on the street, go around and beg and become some wandering spiritual holy man or something. That's not what it's telling you. You don't neglect your portion of this life. You don't neglect it. Right? You assure that there's comfort for your family. You assure there's comfort for yourself. You improve the circumstances of your life. You improve the circumstances of your family and your neighbors and so on. But your main drive is to do good in this life, is to worship God. Now, the Islamic human economic problem then is not one of production. It's distribution. That's the Islamic economic problem. This is what Islam and Islamic thinkers will devote our minds to, is how do we distribute the wealth to satisfy everyone's basic needs as humans. And as for the issue of luxuries, it's laissez-faire. Right, let the profit motive motivate you to get luxuries, that's fine. But we need to focus on satisfying everyone's basic fundamental needs to a comfortable standard. Now, I was on the Big Questions on BBC One once, and I was brought on to talk about Christian Pentecostal spiritual experiences. And they wanted a Muslim to kind of mix things up and said, let's bring a Muslim to talk about Christian Pentecostal experiences. But one of the questions, the big questions, was about, was the Pope right to condemn, capitalism? And I thought, okay, I'm going to get my shot in here. I'm going to actually, talk about the Islamic economic system. So I did. But I was only allowed very brief, like a minute or so, to do so before they kind of cut me off. And then this staunch advocates of capitalism, when I mentioned about distribution is actually the more important thing, said, but what about production? Without production, you wouldn't have resources, you wouldn't have the things to actually consume. But Islam understands that production takes care of itself. Because firstly, in an economic system, when there is a high demand for something and there's a small supply of it, any entrepreneur in that system, and the entrepreneurs occur naturally, of course, they do. Rich people, people that have means, or people that have a great idea, and they will say, "Well, there's high demand for this. I can make a lot of money if I just increase the supply of this or find new supplies of it." So production always takes care of itself. To focus on production myopically and ignore distribution, this is absurd. Production takes care of itself. The economic system, the whole point of an economic system is for distribution. If you think rationally, why do you even have an economic system? What is the point of an economic system for any ideology or any people throughout history? It's everyone lives in different parts of the world, for example, and we all, in our part of the world, we all have little resources and we can access those resources. That's not the problem. That's not an economic problem. Rather, it's how does each human get, exchange those resources with other humans who have different resources or benefit. That's what would be the most rational conclusion. The first conclusion that comes to mind is, how do we do this? How do we exchange? Why? Because we need to actually distribute all the different resources. Because obviously, a farmer might make corn, but he needs to drink milk. His family needs to drink milk. He needs to drink water. He doesn't have water. He needs to get from somewhere else. So then the question is, naturally, distribution and not production. But Islam encourages mankind to seek and develop natural resources. We see in the Quran, God says to Muslims, "It is He who created for you all that exists on earth." And another verse, God says, "Allah is He who put at your disposal the sea so that the ships may sail by His command, and so you may seek His bounty." So seek the bounty which God has placed on the earth for us to use. And again, God says in the Quran, He put at your disposal that which is in the heavens and the earth, all is from Him. So Islam motivates Muslims to exploit resources, to find resources, and to produce and transform these resources into that which is useful for mankind. So we do have the incentive to produce, but distribution is the more important issue. Now, Islam has three basic Islamic economic principles in this matter. One is ownership. Two is disposal of ownership, and three is distribution of wealth amongst people. First and foremost, we believe that all wealth belongs to God, and you can't really own anything. Rather, we're given, you could say, the lease, so to speak, to use it while we're on this earth. So we see in the Quran, it says, and give them from the property of Allah, which He gave you, and spend from what He put you in charge of. So this is, we believe that God has put us in charge of the wealth, but to all wealth belongs to God. Now, I've said about production, I've said distribution is something we need to look at very seriously. But how does Islam manage distribution? Well, first and foremost, contrary to what people might think, where I think I was going with this, Islam does believe in promoting a free market system. We see in the Quran, it says, "O you who believe, squander not your wealth amongst yourselves in vanity, except by mutual trade." We see in the Quran, it says, God has permitted trade. We see that Islam allows supply and demand to determine the prices. So we see that a man went up to the Prophet Muhammad and asked him if he could fix prices for a particular reason. And the Prophet Muhammad said, no, rather it is God who reduces and increases. So the Prophet Muhammad affirmed that you can't fix prices. In Islam, you're not allowed to fix prices on commodities. So it is actually supply and demand which determine price, and Islam believes and advocates trade. So Islam believes in what you might call free market. But a free market with some things which are prohibited and some things which are restricted, but within which it has permitted, there's no regulation. And I'll discuss what I mean by things which are prevented, not prohibited. First and foremost, Islam views that distribution of wealth will occur naturally. What you need to do is prevent concentration of wealth. That's how you tackle the problem of distribution, is basically, people will trade normally, and the price and the free market system will allow distribution of resources, but the problem is preventing concentration of wealth. And Islam has a number of solutions to prevent the concentration of wealth. So we see that, first and foremost, Islam prohibits interest. And we see in the Quran that God has permitted trade and forbidden interest. So we see that in that verse was actually a response to people who said, to the Prophet Muhammad, there were some Jews who were obviously engaged in interest, and they said, well, interest is like trade, they're both the same, you invest and you in with capital, and you make more money out of it than you put in, hopefully. So it's the same. But the Quran rebuked the person who was questioning this and said, well, look, God has permitted trade and forbidden interest. If they were the same, then how could you distinguish the difference between them? You see? And so the Quran made a very eloquent refutation. With the prohibition of interest, you have to understand, why was money invented? Why was it invented? I mean, if you think about it, obviously, as you know, from a barter economy, it's not very convenient. You need to obviously exchange goods which might not necessarily be your neighbor has. So you need to have some kind of store of value or store of services or wealth. And this was what money was about. This is why it was invented. It was meant to be a storage of wealth, storage of value, so that you could trade. That's the point of money. The point of money wasn't to be a system where you can play games with it and then get more money out of that through not doing any economic exchange at all. Playing games of exchanging money and so on. Islam believes that money should be based on gold and silver, a bimetallic system. And so it can't be printed by a private national bank. And so the financial system starts out already free from debt. So you know how they say money is debt, money equals debt in this society. In the Islamic economic system, money does not equal debt. Money is a commodity of itself because it's made from gold and silver. These are commodities. So it has intrinsic value. And of course, obviously, you won't see the kind of inflation that will come about when you use quantitative easing, right? Or they say printing money. Islam prevents private and state ownership of public resources which provide water and energy for the people. So basically, there are the national energy resources, you know, like gas and coal and maybe nuclear power. No one is allowed to own them. It can't be privately owned. It can't be owned by the state, so I'm not calling for nationalization. Rather, it belongs to everybody. And we see that everyone has a right in these resources because they belong to everyone. So we see, for example, a person went up to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and asked him, can you give me an area of land, have some salt there, I could mine that and make some money from mining that. And so the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, okay, sure, you know, you can take it. And then someone who knew that area, who knew that land, went to the Prophet Muhammad and said, you know, O Prophet of God, did you know that in that place there's actually a vast quantity of water. And when the Prophet Muhammad heard about this, he recalled the guy and said, I can't give this to you. You can't receive it because that water belongs to everybody. It can't be privatized. And you see, part of concentration of wealth is that these energy companies who privately own the obviously access to these resources, and they sell it. They sell you basic needs and making a profit on it, a very large profit as well, we see with the current energy companies raising prices and so on. They're making a killing in terms of in the current economic environment, even though there's a recession. You know, people who are rich or those that 1% should not have control over your basic needs. And so, Islam has a system of solving that problem, which is that the people will pay collectively just as enough to extract that and deliver it to them. Some, obviously, back in medieval times or pre-medieval times, if it was a well, you don't need to pay anyone. You just go up to the well and use it, and no one, as long as no one stops you from going to that well, of course. But in this day and age, in the modern economic system, when you need to extract minerals and extract, you know, large amounts of oil and so on and so forth, there could be companies which are hired out by the state on behalf of the people to extract that and provide it to you at cost price. And of course, the incentive to improve production would be that if they can improve production, they could actually make more of that material and decrease the price for you. So the state has a reason to even improve how it extracts those resources. But that the state can't own that money, and neither can any private individual own that money. It belongs, the actual resource belongs to the people. And we also see that in Islam, contracts and debts are not commodities that can be sold as shares or derivatives. Did you know, this is absolutely shocking when I encountered this. The world's GDP, the gross GDP of the world is $65 trillion, estimated at $65 trillion. Do you know the value of the derivatives market? The value of the derivatives market, which is basically, you know, like, you know, how people sell debts and sell all kinds of, I mean, it's kind of all kinds of financial products and things like this, is worth close to $600 trillion. The world doesn't have, the world's GDP is only about 10% of the derivatives market. We also see that with stock markets, where people are buying, and basically, in essence, you're buying and selling shares or contracts of your share in a company. In essence, like, you're part of that company. All companies are formed by contracts. They're formed by contracts which incorporate the people into a company, into a corporation. But what people do in the stock exchange, as you know, is they buy and sell. In essence, they buy and sell these contracts, so to speak, the value of this contract, which gives you a share in that company. Now, this has the effect of undermining the free market system, which using price and supply and demand, because nothing can change in the company. It could be, you know, still have exactly the same supply demand, same prices on his products, selling at the same rate, everything's all the same. But let's say the CEO walks into his office one day, bangs his foot, falls down, and the price drops of the company. The value of the company drops. For all kinds of this, for the ideas of speculators. And that money is, you know, that money, which obviously is how much money the company can use, it can lose that. It can lose the money it uses for its liquidity because of speculation. and nothing to do with a real world economic difference. In essence, imagine the real world economy and the kind of stock market and derivatives as two tables. One table, people are buying, are exchanging goods, real life goods and services. And the other table, they are exchanging the value of, or speculative value of the prices of the first table. It's a parasite economy. Why do you even have that? And it causes so much trouble. When that bubble bursts in the derivative market, really don't want to be involved in that system, but unfortunately I live it. Now, we also see that, as I said that, Islam prohibits the ownership of public resources, there is a reason I say this. The Prophet Muhammad said that the people are not prevented from free things. So the people collectively are not prevented from free things, which is water, pastures, which he means by that livelihood, and fire, which he means energy. So people are not prevented from free things. And this is where what guarantees the rights of the people from being denied or having to have to pay for their basic needs at a profit to the person who supplies it. Islam also prohibits gambling as well, because gambling exploits the poor. As you've heard the saying, the house always wins. It's not a game of pure chance where anyone can win. It wouldn't be a lucrative business and a stable business for the people, the companies that do that, unless they knew they would basically make more money out of it than they put in. So it tends to exploit the poor. Whenever you see a poor area or an area becomes poor, you see a whole bunch of betting shops open up in that area. So in essence, Islam, as you can see, Islam consistently disapproves of increasing money from money. So increasing your amount of money from just money itself. Rather, Islam tries to advocate trading and investment, and I'll get to that in a second. So that was the prohibited means of ownership, of how you acquire ownership. There's also a prohibited means of disposal. So in Islam, people are prevented from hoarding wealth. Firstly, you're not going to make any money if your wealth just sits in a bank account, because there's no interest. So if you want just to let it get spent over time as you spend it with no return, then it's up to you. But in essence, there's no incentive for you to leave your money doing nothing. But even then, Islam tells Muslims, we see it from the Quran, God tells us, and let those who hoard gold and silver and do not spend them in the way of God know that a severe and painful punishment is awaiting them in the hereafter. So as Muslims, we're spiritually motivated to not hoard our wealth, to be scared about hoarding our wealth, because this will be something that will be punishable in the hereafter. That's a spiritual motivation. But there's other motivations we see, as in that there's no interest money, there's no money you'll make on your just hoarding. We see that Islam prevents monopolies as well on foodstuffs and basic utilities. Foodstuffs are things that we need to eat, right? No one can actually have a monopoly on them. So we see the Prophet Muhammad said, no one monopolizes except the wrongdoer. And in another narration he says, it was reported that he forbade that all foodstuffs be monopolized. So no one can control the food you eat. We also see that Islam this is what is prohibited. So this is what I've told you is prohibited. Now, once you put these things out of the way, in everything else, it's free. There's no financial regulation, no regulators over your shoulder monitoring what you're doing or what you're going to do with it. You can do whatever you want. You keep those things, you keep interest banking and out of the way, and you keep hoarding out of the way. You can now do whatever you want. And what you'll see is that there is an encouragement, since the encouragement for Islam to spend your money and not just hoard every day, all the money that was owned by people or was earned by people will be spent back into the economic system. The Islamic economic system will be the most dynamic economic system, because as you say, you have this idea of you need to generate consumer confidence for them to spend. You have to generate consumer confidence to spend, otherwise the shops won't make money and the money won't circulate if you're not getting the people to spend, right? They don't talk about the rich people who hoard. They don't look at them, but they always focus on us to spend our money and the banks to lend us money in debt and we have to pay back the interest. But anyway, we see that Islam gives almost a spiritually based consumer confidence, which encourages Muslims every day to spend or invest their money, or even gift their money. Give it to people in charity, and I'll come to that in a second. So now I've talked about what is prohibited, and I've talked about that in general. Everything else, obviously, is permitted. How does Islam encourage wealth circulation? How does it encourage investment? Well, firstly, we see that in Islam there's a positive encouragement for the cultivation of agriculture. So the Prophet Muhammad said that basically, if you can reach a land which is not being used and you work on it, you own it automatically. If you can find a land not being used and you work on it, you own it. If you have a land and you don't use it, you lose it. So use it or lose it. So they'll give you 3 years, and if you don't use it, then you have to lose it, and you can't lease it. Either you work on it, or you go into a contract of sharecropping, which is basically you employ, you get other people, and you come to the agreement that okay, you guys work on it, and you take a percentage of the produce as profit. You take it for yourselves, and you keep that. We see that in Islam, if a land is irrigated by water, for example, we saw that Prophet Muhammad he reduced the tax on that land by 50%. So if you can irrigate that land, or we're using a water wheel, for example, which was obviously an invention at the time, then you get less. You have to pay less tax. And obviously, if you irrigate it, there's more production. So in essence, the taxes are still the same, because hopefully there'll be more production. But it encourages us to develop our lands, develop these properties. We see that in Islam, the government gives grants to people to develop wealth and to develop land. So, for example, Umar bin Khattab, who was the Prophet's right-hand man, he gave properties to farmers in Iraq, like seed and so on, to help them plant and grow crops for free. Just gave it to them, said, like, you know, use this, and then they became self-sufficient. For example, because in Islam we believe that it is the duty of us to help each other, not just for ourselves. So the government will help and subsidize farmers to actually be self-sufficient. We saw that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam granted Bilal, who was a very famous companion, a place where he could mine a small quantity of minerals for his upkeep, and so on. So he became a miner to a mining sort of quantity of minerals. We also see that in Islam as well, the state revenues will be used to actually get people who are in debt out of debt. So there is actually the government will actually help to get, you know, to remove debt from society. And of course, there's no interest, so there's not going to be problems of compound interest or an ever accruing debt, because there's no money you make on it. And it's very interesting, because Islam, in essence, bails out the people if they're in problems. Whereas in the capitalist system, what we're seeing in most of these countries, they bail out the banks so that they can lend you more money and you be in more debt. And the money they're lending you is your own money you're paying to the government, and so on. The only person, the only government, and now kudos where it's deserved, was Iceland. Iceland, basically, according to Washington-based fund, they decided to let their banks go bust, and instead put that money into widening the social net, the social security net for their people. And this Washington-based fund noted that this actually led to them having a recovery from their economic decline. So that was that's an Islamic principle right there. We see that, as I've said, the nature of the Islamic government is a caliphate. And in the caliphate system, unlike a democratic system, you can't have lobbies which for, you know, big corporate interest paying money to the caliph for his election campaigns, because in Islam, okay, the caliph is elected, but he doesn't have to, as long as he's competent and he doesn't become oppressive or corrupt, he remains in power. As long as he's doing his job correctly and right, then he stays in power. So he doesn't have to always worry about getting money from corporate interests to fund his next election campaign. So he can't be influenced. And so in that way, the Islamic system protects the people from the interests of corporate lobbies. Unfortunately, you can't say the same for the systems here. We also see that there's a spiritual motivation to give interest loans. If you are a rich person in Islam, and this is why I was talking about spiritual values, we see that the Prophet Muhammad said that no Muslim would give another Muslim a loan twice, except that it would be written for him as charity. So that basically, in Islam, we believe that obviously if you give money, you give it away to someone, that's a great reward. If you lend money, that's a reward. But if you give money to someone to help them, that's a great reward. But if you lend people twice, it's equal to you giving money away, to you being a philanthropist. So there's an encouragement. And the rich person who would be a believer in Islam, or be motivated by spiritual values, there's nothing to lose. Just by lending money and getting the same money back, he doesn't lose anything. But he feels a spiritual contentment for doing so, and the motivation for doing so. And we see that there was these trusts were set up, called waqf in Arabic, It's a trust was set up whereby a rich person would set up a hospital or a university or any kind of institution of public good, and that institution would be would generate income by various means, but it would go purely on helping people who were poor, or purely people who couldn't afford an education at university or couldn't afford hospital bills. So we see, and this came from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who looked at who was discussing the palm. There's a palm orchard outside the city of Khaybar, and it belonged to the Islamic State. And he said that give it in charity with its land and trees, on the condition the land and the trees will neither be sold nor given as a present nor bequeathed, but the fruits are to be spent in charity. So the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ kind of ring-fenced that property, and that the production of that of the goods from that property will go purely for charity, be a self-sustaining charity or trust. We also see, as I said before, spiritual motivation for consumer spending and investing. We see in the Quran, it says, let the one who's able to spend the best he can. And we also see in the Quran, it says, let him who has an abundance spend of his abundance, and he whose provision is measured, let him spend of that which God has given him. And we also see other things where the Prophet Muhammad said, exchange gifts amongst yourselves so that you may love each other. So we see this motivation to give gifts, to seek the spiritual values. And as for a Muslim entrepreneur, who wants to please God, who wants a good afterlife, they'll be making lots of money. They'll try to make lots of money, have a great and develop their portfolio and make a lot of money, so that they can have much more money to spend in charity, to send help people, and to get a lot of good deeds in the eyes of God. That's certainly was the situation in medieval Islamic society. We also say that if you could produce and you have excess production, don't throw it away. Because, for example, we saw in one case, I remember, there was a dairy farm and they were throwing away excess milk because if they sold it on the market, it would bring down the price, and they just threw it away. Whereas in Islam, we see the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, whoever prevented the excess water — we're talking about irrigation — so whoever prevented the excess water, to prevent with it the excess pasture, God will prevent him of his bounty on their judgment. So basically, as a Muslim, if you have excess water irrigating your land, let it go to your neighbor's land. Let him benefit from that. Now, otherwise, if you don't, then God will prevent you from benefiting, obviously, in the hereafter. And we also see that Islam made it very easy to invest your money in lucrative projects. So forming companies with very flexible structures was extremely easy. It was so easy that Islam even recognizes verbal contracts. So the contract didn't have to be formalized. But in a court of law, if you can obviously show that you and your partner acted according to a verbal agreement by looking at your actions, the court will recognize it. And apparently in British law, this is also the case as well. You can show that a verbal contract existed as well. So it made it easy for investments to occur through companies to be formed, even off the cuff. And we see, as I said, that public resources free people's expenditure on basic needs. If you don't have to spend money paying inflated bills for your gas and your electricity and so on and so forth, that gives you more money to then use as a private individual to invest, to spend on your family and so on and so forth. And we see also that despite all these mechanisms of circulation of wealth, there will still be a slight disparity where there will be rich people will be making money, and they'll be making more money at a faster rate than poor people, obviously, because obviously the more money you have, the more money you can make, even in a society where you ban interest. So there is one final measure which Islam uses to realign wealth, and this is called the zakat, or the wealth tax. And we see in the Quran, it says, the zakat are only for the poor, the needy, and those who collect them, and those whose hearts are to be reconciled, and to free slaves, and the debtors, and for the way of God, and for the wayfarers. And what this means is basically the eight categories of the collection of the zakat. Firstly, the zakat is for rich people, basically. So if you're rich, you pay the zakat. So the amount, I believe, is 20 gold coins. If you have wealth equivalent to 20 gold coins, or 200 silver coins, you reach the nisab, or the minimum requirement, then you have to pay the zakat. And what we see is that the state collects it, and it must be distributed to eight categories of people. Those who live in absolute poverty, have nothing, like a homeless person or so, have nothing to their name. Those who cannot meet their basic needs, so those who have to delve into their savings to pay their basic food, like we saw happening in the UK, for example, these people need to be helped. The people who collected themselves, those who were enemies and you want to reconcile them, they might have been non-Muslims and you might have had them to a fight, you helped to reconcile, to free people from slavery. Obviously back then slavery was a real thing. Obviously today we don't have legal slavery, you have other forms of slavery, and I foresee that Islamic scholars using jurisprudence will deduce that we should free people from debt slavery and wage slavery, as the modern forms of slavery. We also see that those who've incurred overwhelming debts, the debtors, as I mentioned earlier on, the zakat would be used to get them out of debt. And they won't have to pay compound interest because there's no interest in Islam. So that won't be such a difficult thing for the state to do, or bail out the people. If the USA bail, instead of spending all that money on its banks, it could have just bailed out the people. You know, we could have all had our debt erased, you know, if we were American, and in the UK as well. But no, the banks, we must pay the banks money for them to lend it to us and it with interest. Travelers as well. So if you're a traveler and you run out of money, you can't get back home, again, the zakat will go to you to help you get back home to your abode. Now, coming up to the last part of my lecture, apart from all those other things, there is also other things such as temporary government levies. There is no such thing as a permanent tax in Islam. The Islamic State, the Caliphate, doesn't charge permanent tax. But if there is insufficient amounts to satisfy its objectives or obligations to the people, it will have to levy a temporary tax in order for that need to be satisfied. Now what we see is that the Prophet Muhammad said, any community, whoever they are, if a person among them became hungry, they will be removed from the protection of God, the Blessed and the Supreme. We also see the Prophet Muhammad said, he who goes to sleep while his neighbor is hungry does not have faith. Now in Islam we believe the government, according to the narration of the Prophet Muhammad, the Imam is in charge and responsible for the people. The Imam, the leader. Imam means leader in Islam. So the Imam is responsible for the people. So if people are hungry, the Imam is responsible. And if he has insufficient money, then the obligation returns back to the people to actually give him enough money so that he can give it to the poor person. Because it's an obligation upon all of us then. We all become the neighbor of that hungry person. We see that there's stability in the economic system. I was actually quite shocked when I discovered this. The price of a goat, in the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in the amount of gold and silver coins, is exactly equivalent to the price of it today in the Middle East. I was quite shocked. 1,400 years, 0% inflation. That's quite a good record. Okay, gold goes up and down. It does go up and down, but on aggregate, in the long run, it's stable, because you actually see gold becoming deflated and inflated only by maybe 1% or 2%. If we look at the gold standard when it was implemented in the UK and Europe before they got rid of it, it was generally very stable. But when they got rid of that, we saw inflation rates, for example, for the dollar, which is 3,000% since the implementation rate, 3,000% for the dollar. So the Islamic system, or the bimetallic system, is not artificial paper. It has the money has intrinsic value. You'll see stability with its implementation. And again, that might bring up a lot of questions for people about, bimetallic system, what's the disadvantages? But inshallah, I'll wait for the Q&A for that, and we can go through those questions. There is state property, and it's actually a very fascinating thing. The caliphate, as a state, can actually own property. It owns property, not public, it can't touch public property, but it can own private property, and in a way be a corporation of itself. But unlike a corporation which makes money for its shareholders, the shareholders of the state are the people. So the caliphate might have own businesses, it might own heavy industry. Most governments have connections to heavy industry, because heavy industry is too expensive for any one corporation to fund. In that situation, the profits made by the caliphate as a corporation will go to the shareholders, will go to the people in the state. So in that, the state property is property which Muslim masses have a right. There is a right of it, and its management is left to the caliph to assign some to whom he deems. So for example, land which is owned by the state will be apportioned to people who can work it. Before I mentioned that the Prophet Muhammad used to assign land to people, that was state property, and then he just gave it to people as a grant. And this is how the state helps the people. And as I said, in conclusion, I've gone through quite a lot. It's been quite compact. But I think you'll see, just by looking at the Islamic solution and then comparing it to the current system, a very wide disparity. And this system is not one of those airy-fairy systems where you see, yes, Karl Marx had such a great idea and implementing it would be problematic. It worked. It's been applied for 1,200 years or 300 years until the dissolution of the Ottoman Caliphate. And it generated stability, it generated growth, it generated development. I mean, the Muslims excelled in the medieval ages in technology, they excelled in industry. Where I was from, Al-Andalus had highly sophisticated agricultural systems and manufacturing systems. Damascus, for example, became famous for manufacturing consistently high quality swords, for example. Damascus blades, as they call it today. In the medieval age, being a blacksmith, the quality of your product was never certain. Sometimes you have a really great sword, sometimes you have not so great sword. It was never really certain. But in medieval times, you had the equivalent of a factory producing standardized uniform products. Maybe not just swords as well, all the metalware. But that was just an example because I was reading that regarding the Vikings borrowing techniques from Damascus about how to make swords. Anyway. Different subject, maybe for next year I'll talk about swords and Vikings and Damascus. But you had high developed production facilities in the Muslim world in the medieval ages, far in advance of its time. And all this was because of the entrepreneurship of the Islamic courages, of the encouragement to develop your resources and to expand upon them and to increase production. For what purpose? It was to help each other, to give to each other, to help the poor amongst us, to seek the reward of God. Almost all our universities, almost all our hospitals were wakaf, were trusts, and there were many hospitals and many. It wasn't just maybe one hospital every 200 kilometers. It was had cities with many hospitals. One hospital in Damascus and was serving 1,000 patients, and so on. I've heard all of the statistics in Baghdad of 10,000 patients. I'm not sure how reliable that is, but certainly it was a lot. And that was all done in the medieval ages. So all this progression was done by the implementation of the Islamic system, and the state would only regulate the laws preventing people from engaging in interest and fractional reserve banking. But this was a whole new paradigm. Now, I'll answer this last point. You haven't asked me, but I'll ask this question that you're thinking. Why don't we just take this system and apply it in a Western context? Maybe it might work, that system. And there's one key ingredient you're missing, though. If you have a materialistic worldview, it won't work. It won't work. Because if I told you to basically today spend, gift, or invest all your money, and hopefully God will give it to you tomorrow. You're not going to do that. Right? When there's recession going on, I have to guard my money. I have to hold it. Hold it tight. But as Muslims, you realize that if everyone in the society actually just said, you know what, let's all spend our money or invest it or gift it, all together, then next day all that money that was in your pockets will be back onto the market for people to collect again. And you can't do that if you don't have a spiritual motive or drive. It won't work. Anyway, I hope you've seen. How an Islamic system worked, how it worked in the past, and the fruits it gives. And inshallah, the solutions that it can give for the world today, which I think is in dire need of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Abdullah. Jazakallah khair. So we're going to jump straight into the Q&A, if that's okay. So if you have a question, just raise your hand, and whoever puts their hand up first, I'll do it. So that for now. Yes, brother.
Thank you,
Bona.
Thank you so much for this video. I'd like to ask, is there any limitation on goods profit, for example, if I buy this for one bond, and because the high demand of these things, I will buy it. I will sell it for 5 bonds.
Okay. The price, supply and demand, that's a natural mechanism by which... Sorry? Okay, I'll repeat the question, yes. Gentleman asked, if he had bought a cup for £1 and you sold, could he sell it for £10 or £5 or whatever? If people are willing to buy it, But obviously, when everyone else is selling cups and they'll offer a competitive price, you might not get very far, and so on. So you know, you'll have to judge that yourself as a competent businessman. Islam allows the price and supply and demand to determine price, like in the capitalist system. So it's similar. They're not vastly different. There are similarities in all economic systems, but there is a natural equilibrium that will form between humans exchanging goods, and Islam lets that equilibrium flourish. It just prevents those things that will disrupt the equilibrium and concentrate it into only a small area, which is I really elucidated on.
I'm interested in the Ottoman Empire. There was infinite resources at the time, but we're in a world now where there's finite resources. So I just wondered how the Islamic economic system might work to deal with finite resources.
I don't think there was ever infinite resources ever in the world. There's only so much you can mine. If an Ottoman was here, he'd say, wow, all these drilling techniques you have and all this fishing, you use radar on your fishing boats to detect where the schools of fish are. Man, you guys can produce infinitely, right? They'd think we're producing infinitely now, you see. But no, it was always finite. That's the kind of the...
But today we are meeting the finite limits of the world and possibly the world is warming, and we can't, for example, keep burning fossil fuels because we'll reach a temperature which is unsustainable.
Just to repeat the question, he's saying that in today's world we're reaching the limits of resources, and also we're burning fossil fuels, which is causing global warming. Okay, global warming is a different discussion outside of today's discussion. But in terms of reaching the limit, we actually really haven't reached the limit of people consuming. So there's not more mouths to feed than there are food. There's actually much more food potentially to be produced than people can eat. But what you're seeing is, if you do some research on this, there's massive wastages in the world. Humans no longer just satisfy their desires with food and resources and so on and so forth. They've now, in order to kind of justify this massive production in the West, they've changed humans themselves to being consumers. They're high production, but where do we pull this production? It's like, well, the people are going to have to change. They're going to have to eat more, have to consume more. And even then they can't eat and consume more, so they throw a lot of this food away. Food wastage is horrific. And due to kind of horrendous practices on the market, for example, what Merrick would do in the market, I mentioned about Merrick before, just an assertion, but I now back it up. What they'll do to various developing nations is they'll say, okay, look, you want to be developed, we'll give you a loan. And in exchange, you develop cash crops. So, forget that subsistence, kind of farming you're doing. Get cash crops and you'll make money and you can be developed. And we'll sell you our produce. We'll sell you our products, our industry. Of course, it comes with an interest, bite. And even these countries that have faith and say, yes, okay, I will get rid of subsistence farming, I will sell cash crops to you and you will send us overpriced, industrial produce back. Even then, America, America's one of the many countries, doing this, but I'm just using America as an example. America, from its point of view, is created one, country that's providing, let's say, coffee, for example. But that's not the only country it's told to provide coffee. It's also told other countries to make coffee too. And then it just picks which one provides me the cheapest price. And of course, if it chooses a much more cheaper country, then that country that had faith in the system and adopted their subsistence, got rid of their subsistence farming and adopted this, kind of cash crops, will go into poverty, and they can't compete, and then they're basically stuck, and then we see massive poverty, and we see wars, and we see famine, and we see all these things, which in Africa they never really knew to the level that we have today. For Africa, forget the 20th century being a boon to humanity. For Africans, it was the worst thing that ever happened to them. They had the ability to sustain themselves, now they don't. So I would say that, the problem is not production, it's distribution. But we're taught to look at the world as a problem of production, 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 and it's incorrect. It's always been distribution.
I entirely agree with most of the things you said. It's just that you didn't address, it doesn't seem to have an answer to global warming?
Okay, the issue about global warming, as I said, that's more of a scientific question with scientists, and it's been debated among scientists as to how do we reverse global warming. But all I will say is that thanks to corporate interests for those who, for energy companies who has a stake in you're burning fossil fuels, they were using their lobbying, delayed governments from adopting, renewable energy. Whereas as Muslims, again, using the spiritual values that we are, inculcated into us, we're told to respect the environment, we're told to look after the environment. The Islamic, in medieval times, we actually had kind of areas devoted only to be untouched, green areas, so to speak. That was the first of its kind. So we actually had a respect for nature because although we're given the world to use, we're also responsible for it at the same time. And this occurs in many narrations by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself. So again, capitalism has led to basically this destruction of environment, whereas a more environmentally conscious economic system would not be so destructive and actually would try to make a solution for that.
Just before you answer the question, some people, non-Muslims, are wondering what you mean by sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It's just a term of respect for the Prophet. It means peace be upon him, and that's why the Muslims say it along when you say it. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's Brother Alexander.
Just on this question which was asked, are you able to quote any verse from Quran? It's a side topic, but just about don't kind of exceed in using the resources and protect the environment, and that is directed from. From Quran and Islam, it's slightly different from the economics itself, but that's
sure.
The relevant question of what are Muslim countries doing to kind of the fossil fuels and other things being used.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Okay. The brother asked. Okay. What are Muslim countries doing to in this regard? And where is the evidence in Islam about taking care of the environment? Well, there are many. One of them, for example, even from small things such as removing rubbish from the road and keeping the road clean, which the Prophet Muhammad advocated, to the verse in the Quran, which they said God has made us a vicegerent, a khalifa on earth, and so on, which obviously is that we are now responsible for what we do on this earth, and so on. As I said, do not cause corruption in the land, which I mentioned earlier on. So don't corrupt the land, and unfortunately, in the current world, we're seeing mass corruption of the land due to overdevelopment without regard to renewable, keeping it renewable and so on. So that there are many verses, and I could just pick a few. But with regards to Muslim countries, I mentioned earlier that the system in Islam for the state is the caliphate system. You don't see a caliphate in the Muslim world. You see post-colonial secular states affected by colonialism during the last century and the century before that. And of course, the rulers there have a stake in the current economic system, basically. So even, you might think, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Egypt under the Muslim Brotherhood, whoever you want to mention, they actually have interest banking system in that country. Remember, interest is prohibited. People say Iran and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, all these are Islamic states, Islamic countries, but they actually permit interest banking. So then how are they Islamic? It's a veneer. I mean, just by wearing different clothes or Arabic clothes doesn't make you Islamic. You see, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of that. So what we actually want to see is a caliphate which would look after the needs of Muslims. Now, I mentioned Muslims. I didn't kind of have time to explain this fully, but also we're also responsible for all human beings. So the son of Adam. So that's why I said the son of Adam means all human beings. And so as Muslims, we also have to help out non-Muslims who are poor and so on. And we see in the Quran, it says, what is wrong with you that you fight not for the weak and oppressed amongst the earth? It says, it's a general, for the weak and the oppressed amongst earth, we have to fight for them, to protect them, defend them militarily and economically as well. So we have this consideration. But the problem is, for capitalism countries, if you see a caliphate restored, with a bimetallic system, not accepting dollars, not accepting euros, not permitting exploitation of our resources, developing our own industry, and not needing to buy exorbitant priced goods from their countries, it's not going to be good for business. Quite simply, they have an interest to prevent a caliphate from developing, because they know exactly what that will lead to. Okay, forget about this clash of civilizations and holy wars and crusades. There's a more simpler explanation, really, is that it will really dent their economy severely, when they have to, they actually have to pay better, you know, prices for the resources that we give them. And we'll be devoting a lot of those resources actually to our own industry, not just giving it to them, but actually developing it to our own industry and making our own goods. You know, as now, I'm not a supporter of Lenin and Stalin, but Lenin and Stalin said something very interesting when they created their Russian state, their Soviet state. They said that basically we're not going to import tractors anymore until we can make them. Basically, and that's a good, you know, like that. I mean, okay, I disagree with everything else they believe in, but that is a good. That is exactly that I would call an Islamic sentiment. Obviously, it was just you know, what they said is exactly what Islam would inculcate Muslims, that we should be self-sufficient, and then we trade as equals, not trade as beggars in the global economic system.
Okay, next question: this brother in the green scarf, and then brother in the blue scarf.
We'll be, if you're not wearing a scarf, then you're not going to be picked, are you?
Thank you so much for having come here. Until today, I was completely unaware of you. My teachers at the Muslim faculty are aware of who you are. Just a question regarding something you touched on with a bimetallic gold dinars and silver dirhams. Are you aware of any successful attempts taking place now? In smaller communities worldwide, wherever you've given your talks, or indeed any organisations that are successfully getting word out regarding the importance of using gold dinars and silver dirhams?
Well, okay. My brother said that. Am I aware of any organisations or groups, or at any level, I suppose, which are trying to call for the re-establishing of the bimetallic system? I suppose in the world, or just the Muslim world, or anywhere, I suppose. Okay, well, I mean, I only know of the Muslim, what's happening in the Muslim world, and I would argue is that obviously there are many groups. I mean, there are many groups which obviously groups which we know call for caliphate and call for you know, Islamic State. So I heard this in Norwich, there's a Murabitun, I believe, it's the Murabitun. They call for a gold dinar, and they were trying to unveil the gold dinar. And you had other groups which call for caliphate and re-establishing like Hizb ut-Tahrir, and I suppose various other Islamic groups around the Muslim world. But just calling for it, calling for just implementing a gold dinar devoid of a state is not gonna happen, because the state has to underwrite the economic system. It says this is legal tender. If you don't have a state saying that, then there's no point just saying, well, hopefully everyone please use gold dinars and, you know, distribute them around. It's not gonna happen, right?
It can happen from a community level.
Again, you can't make you can't change a paradigm of society without the thing that brings that society into existence as a society with based on values and ideas, and that is obviously an ideological state, a state that implements an ideal and will enforce rules according to that ideal. So again, like, you know, it's like, I mean, just to kind of look at it from, let's say, from the Western perspective, if I would say, you know, we have a free market system without government, basically, it won't happen, because who's going to police people who default on contracts or who steal? So you need, who's going to say that, you know, that banknote you have in your, that piece of paper you have in your wallet, of which you have so much confidence in, is legal tender? You see, because without the British government, that piece of paper is just a piece of paper. See, so you have to have a state to underwrite the legal tender of that country before it can actually be legal tender and be adopted by it must gain currency. Currency must gain currency by means of a state.
You need this last.
Yeah. Something related to that.
I'll get back to you, but I just want to ask more many people as possible. Yeah, shall I give them a chance?
How does the principles of Islamic banking compare with the current banking system?
Okay, the gentleman asked, how do the principles of Islamic banking compare with the current banking system? Well, I believe in... I would just... make a kind of answer your question from medieval times. What happened in medieval times? There was work of institutions whereby they would allow you to basically deposit money in these institutions, and then they'll give you a check, and you can go halfway across the world and cash that check in an equivalent institution that will take that. So it's like the first checking system, basically. And in essence, the work of it was produced by people who donate money, so that money can be in that institution to lend and get, and obviously people pay it back, no interest. But that will accrue good deeds for the good deeds in the eyes of God for that rich person, even though he loses no money. you see, and that was a great incentive. The modern banking system obviously is very different to that because they obviously want to make money from playing money games, and so what they'll do obviously, as you know, is they will lend out money demanding interest in return, even though there's not enough money in the world to pay back all the debt in the world. There's not enough, literally not enough money in the world to pay. It's quite a very strange system. And of course, fractional reserve banking led to that
I was talking about what they are marketing as Islamic banking now.
Sure. Oh, yeah. the current state now, of Islamic current banking.
I'm not talking about what was before. I'm talking about the current marketing strategy of this Islamic banking.
Okay.
How does that compare with, I don't know whether these are allowed or not allowed or not.
Well,
because banking means it involves interest, isn't it? So.
The current state of Islamic banking is they lend you money and then you pay them back with plus bank charges, which seem to be proportionally related to how much money you've given. Now, you know, calling a spade, it's kind of like me saying, yeah, this is halal pork, basically. You know, just say Bismillah and so on. You know, if it looks like a duck, you know, it's a duck, right? It cracks like a duck and so on and so forth. So I would say that they just repackage the same financial services, same financial products with different name and so on. So don't give much credence to the modern ideas going around. What's this over there?
This is in front of you.
And
this,
and,
oh, it's
Okay, so this asks a very good question. If the Islamic economic system was implemented for quite some time, why did it cease to exist? Well, okay, it only ceased to exist when with the destruction of the Ottoman Caliphate in 1922 or 24, depending on where you want to set your dates with that. But in essence, the reason for the collapse of the Islamic civilization itself, in terms of vis-a-vis the Western civilization, as in old world, the decline, not really collapse, more of the decline, was nothing to do with economics. It was actually more to do with our kind of civilizational atrophy. I think the best way to put it is the worst thing that ever happened to the Muslims was our success in about 1500s. We reached pinnacle civilization, and we did what every civilization does, what Ibn Khaldun, the grandfather of sociology, predicted, which is that once you reach a state of luxury, you reach a state of equilibrium, then the society tends to just kind of like almost relax and enjoy the luxuries and just enjoy the good life, and they cease being innovative, dynamic, and kind of being forward thinking. And then they switch to saying, well, look, we've got such a great civilization. We are, you know, supreme in economics, politics, military, all these things. Let's just conserve what we have. This is their mentality. We conserve. The birth of conservatism. It was the birth of looking back to the past, of preserving the past, as opposed to looking forward. And that occurred because of our success. Again, it's a sociological phenomena. And then it's atrophy of thinking. So I'll give you an example. You know, this is a gross generalization. But you see some of the people who are like the most, because they're quote-unquote dumbest people in the world, are the kids of rich people, of very rich people, let's say. You know, the ones who basically go out and spend $1,000 on a T-shirt or something, for example, you know, and then have to, you know, like rest the whole day because they've had a tiring day, right? You know, such people... you know, you've noticed why are they like this? Why are they so shallow? Why? It's because they don't have to think. There's no problems in their life that motivates their thinking. Everything's there on a silver platter. So with the Islamic civilization around 1500s, when they had developed their agriculture to the peak of its time, when they had, you know, they were food secure, they were militarily, you know, dominant. They had no threats. Okay, there was a few, you know, Mongol problems, but that was dealt with. And the Mongols even converted to Islam, and so on. You know, they just relaxed in essence, and they sat back, and then the decline of thinking that had occurred in the Muslims, whereby Islam just became now a set of rituals and was understood only superficially as just a set of words you give lip service to, and they forgot the spirit of Islam, the spirit that of the entrepreneurship, of the innovative nature of Islam. Right? It's a transforming project. Islam. It's not there to be kind of keep things fixed in time. It's actually meant to transform the world, bring us close to God by developing new technologies that help us make us close to God. For example, I mean, just using a modern example, if there was no decline of Islamic civilization. And we reached, we probably would have done it earlier, but we would have developed YouTube, for example, the equivalent, right? You know why we want to develop YouTube? It's because you could put beneficial educational lectures on YouTube and get thousands of people watching it with no further effort of your own. You know, you just put your video up, and thousands of people will be watching beneficial lectures or good, you know, advice you give. And in Islam, we believe that every person that benefits from, you know, good advice you say or something you teach, you get a reward from God. So it would be great for a person to say, you know what, I just do a little bit of effort, maybe 5 minutes in front of the camera, and I get thousands of good rewards from people all around the world looking at and benefiting from my advice. See, incentive, motivation for development, motivation for in making new technologies. This is exactly how a kind of an ideological Muslim would look at it. But the Muslims that, you know, from after the 15th century, 16th century rather, we stagnated in time, and we didn't no longer develop new markets. Did you know the ultimate, like, they discovered the new world, right? They discovered the new world full of opportunity, and there was a rush from the European nations to go there and colonize, right? And the Ottomans was like, meh. It's like, Ottomans were thinking, why do we need to go over there? We've got such a good life here. And then obviously, they let the Europeans go there, and then the Europeans basically got so much resources, brought so much gold and minerals, and then the Europeans basically then made much, you know, then basically with that gold, they went into Ottoman markets and started buying out all the resources in Ottoman markets, and then that made it even worse for Ottomans. Then their armies were well equipped because they had so much wealth, and then, you know, the Ottomans started to lose battles and things like that. I mean, it's a long discussion, but in essence, why wouldn't Ottomans, you know, also go to the new world and develop it and see what they can do? I mean, you know, if they actually did it, they wouldn't have actually even killed the natives and subjugated them. They would actually probably have co-opted the natives, as Islam always does when it goes to a new area. It doesn't actually kill people, massacre people, force them to be slaves or what have you, but rather it actually co-opts the people into the economic system. This happened in Al-Andalus, it happened in all other areas in the world and so on. That's quite interesting discussion. So anyway, in a nutshell, I hope that's answered your question, sister, somewhat.
The brother, the son, the previous question you criticized that the financial product in Islam, which is the murabaha, tawarraqa thing, you say that as like hard work, which is not true. So sorry, say again louder, so I can't hear you. The previous question you criticized that about the proper Islamic finance product, which is like tawarraqa, murabaha, which is currently done in some Islamic countries.
Which is, I'm disagreeing with you about that. That the proper way of doing financial Islamic product, which is a good way to finance yourself as a trade or as a businessman. However, which is in some country now, they do it in wrong way. Which is they do it as just covering it with the Islamic face. But the real Islamic finance product is there.
Okay, I think you're agreeing with me. like basically, yeah, the principles of Islamic banking, obviously, you know, we agree with, but people are claiming to do it, but it's not actually Islamic banking. It's using interest and so on and so forth. So you're putting an Islamic face on it. But I would agree. This is the problem because it misleads some Muslims who believe it is it is interest free banking.
For example, in Saudi Arabia. There is many non-Islamic projects, and there's some bank they do as proper Islamic bank. So that's one example. In other countries, there is and banks can do a proper Islamic finance.
Sorry about that. We've gone a bit over time with the questions. The food has arrived at the Islamic Center, so
are you free to come?
I want to quickly answer his question and one more question. And then
okay, so we'd have one more question after the brother's question.
Okay, I think if you look in Saudi Arabia, what they do is the banks that don't claim to offer interest, what they'll kind of do is they'll buy, let's say, a house or a car for you on your behalf, and they calculate how much they would have made if they charge you interest, and then they sell it to you at this higher price. And in essence, it becomes exactly the same, no difference to interest banking. And of course, if you default in their payments to the bank, they keep your money and the car, which in Islam is an incomplete contract, because if you default, they have to return back the money you've paid so far, and they get back the product. But they don't do that. That's not an Islamic-based agreement or deal. So I would disagree with you there. There was someone from the audience, I think, another question. I think you sir.
That's my question about interest rate.
Sure.
Is another way of investment. Why is it prohibited in Islam?
Okay, well, as I said before, the brother said, what about was it interest rate? Was it not a form of investment? In essence, all things you apply your wealth to are an investment. You could say everything you apply your wealth to is an investment. But there are some things which you're not allowed to make money from, and you're not allowed to make money just from money, playing games with money itself. Money, what is the purpose of money? It's meant to be a means of exchange for goods and services or commodities, not in itself a means to make money, to give you extra, you see? So that was where the Islamic prohibition against interest will come from, that you're abusing what money is. And secondly, this actually promotes concentration of wealth. And that is the primary culprit for concentration of wealth, and that you have to kind of deal with that to create a system that's more just for people. And so that's just basically the prohibition. Obviously, as we believe that in Islam, God knows best than we do as to what is good and bad. And so we take, obviously, as a commandment, but this is the wisdom behind the command from God, that you're preventing concentration of wealth, and it's just absurd. You're using money to make money, to make money, whereas money is meant to be used for, has a purpose for something else, which is just to facilitate exchange. So make money for exchange. Why do you need to, and you're contributing to distribution if you do that, but why make money from money? You're not actually contributing anything to exchange. That's the reason.
That is the end of the Q&A session here. Thank you for coming. I'd like to say, if you want to come for the food, but you're short of time, then just come down to the Islamic Center. We'll pack it for you. Otherwise, we're going to have the dinner there. Brother Abdullah Andalusi is going to be there. So if you don't mind, any questions that were given to you.
You can come harass me.
You can come harass him, basically, yeah. So, thank you all for coming. If you don't know where the Islamic Center is, we're all going together now. It's literally a minute away. It's just where CD Annex is. So, thank you all. Thank you.